Dune. That's it. McDonald sat back down. The general conversation noise started up again, and people started reaching for their phones. Neve was one of them. Okay, so having a base named Tanaka is not helpful at all, they said after a minute. The first Google references are for a baseball player. I'm on Wikipedia, Kahuragi said. It says Tanaka is the fourth most common family name in Japan. There are a bunch of notable Japanese with the name. So, we have no clue about anything other than we're going to Greenland, Aparna said. And that we're probably doing something with polar bears, I noted. Or seals, Aparna added. So let me ask this, I said. I know why I'm here. I was broke and desperate and needed a job, or I was going to be homeless and starving. What about you all? The newbies all looked at each other. Pretty much the same, Kahuragi said. It's a fucking pandemic out there, mate, Neve said. I'm here because of a bad breakup, Aparna said. And, well, money. It's like the Foreign Legion for nerds, I said, and laughed. With polar bears. Or seals, Aparna added. A few hours later, we newbies, along with every other KPS staffer, filed out of the Chesapeake Club and boarded a charter plane. As promised, we were all seated together, but I was in a row with an unoccupied seat, which was taken by a young airman who asked me why I was going to Thule. I gave him the line about being from the Department of the Interior. I have never seen someone's eyes go dead with disinterest that fast. He put on headphones. I went to sleep. 6.5 hours later, we were at Thule Air Base. I wondered how long we would stay, and the answer was, as long as it took for us to get off the plane, get collected by KPS staff, and shoved into a pair of what I was later told were cold-modified Chinook helicopters, which took off immediately and started heading inland. Where are we going? I asked Tom Stevens, who had waved me over to sit next to him as I got into the helicopter. We had to lean into each other to talk. I don't know much about Greenland, but I do know there's nothing in the middle of it but glaciers and cold. Okay, see, this is cool, Tom said. There was a U.S. base called Camp Century that was officially closed in the 1960s. It was a military research base. It had its own nuclear reactor for power that was shut down when the base closed, right? Okay. It's a lie, Tom said. A cover-up. Camp Century never closed down. Neither did its nuclear reactor. KPS uses it now. That's where we're going. We're going to a secret nuclear base in Greenland? I said. I told you it was cool. Okay, but how do you keep a nuclear base secret? I asked. I pointed upward. I don't know much about physics, but I know the Russians and the Chinese have spy satellites. I'm pretty sure they'd notice, I don't know, neutrons or whatever? You'll see, Tom said. I was suddenly very annoyed at the smug secrecy of KPS. A bit over an hour later, and we were on the ground at Camp Century, hustled from the helicopters to transport trucks to a garage-like area that sealed up behind us. A KPS staffer told us to put any carry-ons, backpacks, or personal effects on a baggage claim-like conveyor belt. I looked over to Tom at this. It's fine, he said. Sterilization. You'll get everything back. I shrugged and put everything on a conveyor. Then we queued up and checked in at tables. When I got to the front, I was given a bundle of plastic-sealed clothes and shoes and a bag and pointed to a shower area. Old clothes and shoes in the bag, including everything in your pockets and any removable jewelry, and put the bag in the collection bin, the KPS staffer said. Shower thoroughly using the soap provided. Use it everywhere, including your hair, and get down into the scalp. When you're done, do it again just as thoroughly. If you wonder if you did it enough, do it again. Then put on the new clothes and head to the waiting area beyond the shower room. I went in, stripped, and showered. The soap smelled like a combination of chlorine and raspberry, which was not a combination I ever really wanted to experience again. The new clothes were a jumpsuit of sorts, gray and with close elastics at the neck, wrists, and ankles, with shoes being a weird sort of light boot. Utilitarian underwear and socks were provided. I put it all on and then followed the signs to the waiting area. Eventually, Aparna came in, followed by Neve and Kahurangi. I don't have a mirror, so you tell me, Kahurangi said, and posed. Flattering? Sure, I said. That's funny because it looks like shit on you. I smiled at that. I heard my name, turned, and saw Tom waving me over. I excused myself from the newbies and went over to him. Stick with me, he said. Okay, I said. Why? Because I want to see your face when it happens. I gave him a sour look. This secrecy bullshit, I swear. I know, he said. Would you believe me if I told you it's worth it? It better be. On the far side of the room, a light came on over a door. The door opened, rolling up like it was on a garage. Come on, Tom said, and guided us inside this new room, maneuvering us close to the similarly garage-like door on the other side of the room. Others filled in behind us until the room was packed with people in goofy gray jumpsuits. The door behind us rolled shut. I feel like someone is about to pull a prank on me, I said to Tom. It's not a prank, he said. The lights went out. You were saying? I said back to him in the darkness. You remember I told you about the nuclear reactor here? What about it? We're using it now. Using it for what? There was a huge, wrenching thunk. I instinctively hunched down in the darkness. Behind me, at least a couple of people screamed and yelled in surprise. For that, Tom said. I was going to remark how I was going to punch him when the lights came back on, and the door in front of us started going up. As it did, air rolled in from the outside. Hot, heavy, humid, and so dense I could see light diffract in it as it poured in. The door rolled up all the way. Outside was a jungle. I gaped. That's what I wanted to see, Tom said. I ignored him and stepped out into a wide pavilion, obviously designed to accommodate arrivals. I went to its edge. The arrival area was 10 or more meters up. Below was a base of some sort, shot through with green life that was obviously untamable. It might be cleared temporarily, but it would come back faster and greener. That green built toward the perimeter of the base to an immense wall of vegetation that grew higher and bolder than any I had ever seen in my life, either personally or in documentaries. It made the Amazon rainforest look like a parking lot. I took in a breath. It was like chewing on pure oxygen. I looked to the left and saw the other newbies standing with me, mouths similarly agape. All right, where the fuck are we? Asked Neve. Greenland, Tom said from behind us. Neve turned. Mate, this is not Greenland, they said. It's green. I promise you, it is Greenland. Tom held up a hand to forestall objections. Just not the one you're used to. I promise you there's a good explanation. We have an orientation session that goes into it. Or you could explain it now, I said. Fine. This is Greenland. It's just on a slightly different Earth. Neve motioned emphatically at all the green. Slightly different? Gotta go with Neve's assessment at your use of slightly, Kahurangi said. All right, very different, Tom allowed. How different? Aparna asked. Tom pointed at the green. Well, that's not the wildest part. What do you mean, I asked, and then noticed a shadow cover me, the rest of the newbies, Tom, and the entrance pavilion. I looked up, along with everyone else, to watch what looked like a 747 lazily flap its wings across the sky. Is that a dragon? Aparna asked after a long minute. Technically not a dragon, Tom said. Technically? Neve exclaimed. Kahurangi nodded and pointed. Once again, Neve speaks for me. If it's not a dragon, what is it? I asked. It's a kaiju, Tom said. A kaiju. Yes. An actual fucking kaiju, I repeated. Like the Japanese movie monsters. Almost exactly like that, Tom said. Hey, I told you we worked with large animals. Dude, I thought you were talking about polar bears. Tom laughed and shook his head. Nope, actual fucking kaiju, as you put it. It's in the name, after all. What? I said. KPS, Tom said. It stands for Kaiju Preservation Society. That's who we are, Jamie. That's why we're here. That's what we do. From the distance, a low, rumbling roar rolled over us. I turned and watched as a small mountain on the horizon stood up and looked in our direction. Chapter 5. So this is Tanaka Base, I said to Tom, after I had managed to pick my jaw up from the pavilion sidewalk. He shook his head. This is Honda Base, he said. He caught my look. It's not named after the car company, I promise you. It's named for Ishiro Honda. He directed the original Godzilla movie in 1954. All the North American bases are named after the people who made the movie. Tanaka Base, Chukokita Base, Nakajima Base, and so on. Tanaka is named for the movie's producer. There were other Tanakas involved with the movie, though. It's a common name. The fourth most common in Japan, Kahurangi said. Someone was looking at Wikipedia before we left, Tom observed. Naming your bases for Godzilla filmmakers is a little on the nose, Neve said to Tom. It is, Tom admitted. We sort of lean into that here. You have to, because how could you not, right? You can't pretend you don't know, and not just with kaiju movies. You have no idea how difficult it was for me to not say, "Welcome to Jurassic Park," to all of you just now. Jurassic Park didn't end well for anyone in it, I pointed out, book or movie. Well, they were sloppy, Tom said. We're not sloppy. And they were fictional. This is real. But how is this real? I asked. How do we walk into a room in an icy Greenland and walk out in one that's a jungle? And has dragons, Aparna added. Technically not dragons, Tom said to her, and then looked at all of us, taking the newbies in as a group. Come on, let's get lunch, and I'll explain there. The Honda Base commissary was the size of a small town market, and offered a salad bar and buffet. All of us newbies looked at it uncertainly. What is it? Tom asked, his plate ready. You're holding up the line. We just came from a world where salad bars and buffets are no longer a thing, I reminded him. It's fine. Look, he went around me and started digging in. All of this produce looks very boring, Neve said. You could get it in any developed country. You're wondering where the native produce is, Tom said. Yeah. You wouldn't like most of it. Why not? Because our produce has been designed by us for centuries to be things we want to eat, Aparna said to Neve. Nothing here has been cultivated with us in mind. Aparna looked at Tom. Right? Tom nodded. We grow the produce here in greenhouses. It's just not of here. But if you're feeling adventurous, you can try some of those. He pointed down to the end of the salad bar. We all looked. Mate, those look like fossilized turds, Kahurangi said. That's why we call them poop fruit, yes, Tom said. You need to talk to your marketing people, I suggested. They taste better than they look. They would have to, wouldn't they? A couple of minutes later, we were all seated at a wooden picnic table inside the commissary, because even the few minutes out in jungle Greenland was a wilting experience. The plan, Tom told us, was to have lunch, and then we and every other member of Gold Team would be on our way to Tanaka Base. But first, some explanations. I'm not a scientist, Tom said to us as we ate. None of us braved the poop fruit. And I know you are. Well, most of you, he nodded at me. And the one of you who isn't is an expert in science fiction. So, I'm going to leave the scientific details to other people. I'm just going to tell you what they told me when I was in your shoes. Like how this place exists at all, I said. Right. So, to start, and, well, clearly, Tom waved around, taking in the whole planet. Alternate Earths exist. I'm told in theory that there are an infinite number of them, but this is the only one we can get to. So far, anyway. And it's the same as ours? I asked. Well, I think you've noticed there are some differences. You said North American bases earlier. This implies a North America. Oh, okay, I see where you're going. Yes, in a very broad sense. This Earth has the same basic continents as ours, but there are some significant differences because this version is so much warmer. There are no ice caps here, so there's also no Florida here, or a lot of what we think of as the eastern seaboard of the United States. Everything from Boston to Savannah is underwater, or would be if they existed here, which they don't. Also, we know that this Earth exists roughly in the same time-space moment as ours. How do you know that? Kahurangi asked. Tom pointed to Neve. I bet you would know, he said. The stars are the same, I'll bet, Neve said to him, and then looked at the rest of us. If we look up in the sky and see the same constellations that we see at home and they're not distorted, we're in the same place in the universe. In this universe, anyway. They turned back to Tom. And you say they look like what you expect them to. I mean, I know the Big Dipper and Orion, and that's it, Tom said. But they're up there, where I expect to find them. Other astronomers we've had here confirm the rest of it. So what explains the difference in climate then? Aparna asked Tom. Lots of different theories, with part of the leading being that we don't think there was a Chicxulub impactor on this Earth. You know, the meteor that took out the dinosaurs. We all looked at him impatiently. And, of course, all of you know what the Chicxulub impactor was, and I'm the one who looks like an uneducated dork for not knowing what it was called by name when I first got here, Tom said, only a little bitterly. But you just said that we're in the same place in space-time, Aparna said to Neve. Why wouldn't the asteroid have hit here? Just because the stars are in the right place doesn't mean every single interaction in space has been exactly the same, Neve said. Our solar system has 8 major planets, dozens of minor planets and moons, and about 100,000 objects larger than a kilometer. All of them interact with each other, and that's not even factoring in the Oort cloud. Never forget to factor in the Oort cloud, I said, with mock seriousness. There's too much chaos in the system for things to act perfectly predictable at the scale of asteroids or planets, Neve said, ignoring me. So, it's entirely possible that the asteroid that hit our Earth 65 million years ago missed this Earth completely, or possibly never even existed. And also that things that missed us in our universe hit this Earth here, Kahurangi said. He turned to Tom. What do the rocks say? Where are the dividing lines? You'll have to check with the actual scientists, Tom said. But yeah, that's the thinking. We missed some extinction events here and may have gotten other ones. So you think these monsters evolved from dinosaurs? Aparna asked. She had a frown on her face that I suspected was what happened when she, as a biologist, was told something she was going to disagree with on a visceral level. Tom pointed. No, he said. That I know. The kaiju have a whole other biology entirely. Technically, they're not even animals. So they're what, I asked? Very angry plants? Vengeful fungi? None of those things, Tom said. Their biology is different from anything we have back home. Very different. Don't think of them in terms of kingdoms of life. Think of them as biological systems. Kind of ecosystems in themselves? He turned to Aparna. I can't tell you more than that, I'm sad to say. It's not what I do here. Aparna looked very dissatisfied with this answer. What do you do here? Kahurangi asked. My official title is Base Operations Executive, Tom said. My unofficial title is that guy who keeps schedules and has to fix shit when it goes wrong. He pointed to me. Jamie here is going to be doing all of my grunt work. I lift things, I confirmed. How long has this been going on? Neve asked. I started with KPS 3 years ago. No, not you, Neve said and gestured. This. Right, sorry. Well, if you want to go all the way back, it started when Godzilla showed up on our Earth. What? Aparna got to the what first, but we were all getting there. So, again, no scientist, Tom warned. We've established that, I said impatiently. Nuclear fission and fusion do more than make energy. They also thin the barrier between universes. All the scientists immediately drew up at this to raise objections. Tom raised his hand. I know. Feels like bullshit, even to me. There is science behind it. I just don't carry it around in my head. Point is, we started setting off nuclear bombs on our planet, and the kaiju on this planet sensed the detonations from here and started homing in on them. Why would they do that? Asked Aparna. It looks like food to them. What? Aparna caught herself when she remembered Tom wasn't a scientist. Go on, she said grimly. Tom nodded. In May 1951, the U.S. set off a prototype of a hydrogen bomb at a place called Inuitok Atoll. It's in the Marshall Islands. 2 days later, one of the kaiju crossed over at the detonation site. The actual fucking Godzilla, Kahurangi said, which, to be clear, looked and acted nothing like the Godzilla of the movies, Tom said. It was just huge and hungry and stomped around for a bit looking for something to eat before the U.S. Navy spooked it and it took off into the ocean. Then what happened? It swam away from the Navy for 3 days and then died and sank in the Japanese shipping lanes. That's why we have Godzilla. Japanese sailors saw the U.S. Navy chasing something big, talked about it when they got back to Japan, and the story found its way to the filmmakers. I am officially skeptical about this Godzilla origin story, I said. That's fine, Tom said. The thing was, it kept happening. The U.S. had it happen 4 more times, once in the Nevada desert. The Soviets had it happen at least 3 times. The French and the United Kingdom at least once each. It was enough of a problem that in 1955, there was a secret meeting of the nuclear powers to try to figure out how to keep it from happening. Their solution was to fund a project that crossed over to here to keep the creatures from trying to come over to our world. The Kaiju Preservation Society, I said. Our predecessor organization, yes. Less concerned about preserving the Kaiju than just keeping them on this side of the universal fence until the holes we tore through it with our bombs closed up again. And how would they do that? Kahurangi asked. Lots and lots of daisy cutters, is my understanding, Tom said. We don't do nuclear testing anymore, though, I pointed out. No, we don't, Tom agreed. And one reason, obviously not in any treaty, is that keeping the kaiju out was more of a hassle than the nuclear powers wanted to deal with. There was also the consideration that the aftermath of a nuclear exchange would include 50-story monsters coming through a multidimensional tear to wreak havoc on any survivors of the ICBMs. That's nice, Neve said. It's okay if we turned entire cities full of people into nuclear ash, but the idea of monsters having a nibble afterward was just too much. My point is, there's no threat of the kaiju crossing over today, I said, and then motioned around. So why this? Why are we still here, you mean, Tom said. Yes. Well, there's the science of it, of course. Tom waved to the rest of the newbies. Your new friends here are going to be doing work that has never been done before. It's literally a whole new world, and we've just scratched the surface of it. We're doing things here that no one else gets to do, never will get to do. That's awesome. But we won't get to share what we do, Aparna said. We'll be doing science in a vacuum. You get to share it, Tom said, just with a very small number of fellow scientists for now. In the future, that might change. In which case, each of you is going to become a rock star in your respective fields. That won't suck. He turned back to me. This is where lots of our funding comes from these days, by the way. Governments still fund us, but less so than they used to. But the same billionaires who are racing each other to get to Mars are bankrolling us in the hopes that something we learn here will be applicable back home in a general, this doesn't look like it came from another planet way. Or they're funding us to have somewhere to go if things go to shit back home, Neve suggested. I'm sure some of them might have thought about that, Tom said. I'm not sure it's going to work out for them the way they'd planned. They'd be better off with Mars. Why's that? It has a lot fewer predators, for one. It's not just the science, though, is it? I said, bringing the topic back round. No, Tom said. We're not called the Kaiju Preservation Society just because it's a catchy name. It turns out the kaiju really could use some help. What does a creature the size of a small mountain need with humans? Kahurangi asked. I promise you that you will find out, Tom said. But what we do is more than keep the kaiju on this side of the fence. We also keep others out. What do you mean? I asked. It's like I said, nuclear energy thins the dimensional barrier. Tom motioned to show off Honda Base. We keep Camp Century humming along because it's nicely positioned for various reasons I don't understand to make it easy to open the door between our worlds and then to close it back up again each time in a predictable fashion. It, and a couple of other sites on the globe run by other signatories to the Kaiju Defense and Protection Treaty, are the only official ways in and out of Kaiju Earth. They are tightly controlled and secured. There's a reason we've managed to keep this all a secret for so long. But nothing is that secret anymore, Tom continued. Governments and companies know Kaiju Earth exists. They have to, in order for us to do our work and get our funding. We control the doors to this world. But if you're ambitious, you can slip past the guards. Or, if you're ambitious enough, you can blow a hole in the fence if you want to. You just have to know how. And when that happens, and it has happened before, both our worlds are in danger. Kaiju are a danger to humans, sure, but it works the other way, too. They could step on us and not even notice, Kahurangi said. Mosquitoes kill more humans every year than every other type of animal combined, Tom said to him, including other humans. And to flip that around, humans have wiped our version of Earth clean of almost every single animal much larger than we are. We hunt them to extinction, and we put ourselves into their environments. Size isn't the issue. It never was. So we're the monster police, too, I said to Tom. Correct, he replied. The only real question is, who are the monsters? They ask that question in every monster movie, you know. It's an actual trope. I know, Tom said. What does it say about us that it's relevant every single time they ask it? Chapter 6. We newbies were all thinking it, but this time it was Neve who got to it first. We're flying in that? That, in this case, was an immense dirigible that looked like it was prototyped by a kaiju-sized Leonardo da Vinci in the 15th century and minimally maintained since then. Everyone else on the Tanaka-based gold team was going up the gangways like it was no big thing. What were you expecting? Tom, who had directed us to the airfield, asked Neve. Something far less rickety. It's a solid craft. Mate, that looks like an advertisement for alternate world tetanus. We did get our shots, Kahurangi said. There are no shots for that, Neve countered. The Shobijin is totally safe, Tom said. In fact, it's the safest airship you'll ever be in. Convince me, Neve said. It looks like it will go up Hindenburg style if I stare at it too hard. One, it uses helium, not hydrogen, Tom said. A hydrogen airship would be a bad idea here, so it won't explode. Two, he pointed to the frame of the airship, it's mostly made of two local elements that we have in abundance here, bellwood and kaiju hide. Bellwood grows fast like bamboo, is both incredibly light and strong, and is fire resistant. How fire resistant? If you put a log of it on a fire, the fire would die. And as for the kaiju hide, well, not much gets through that. Keeps helium in, keeps things on the outside out. So, yeah, the Shobijin looks like bad handicrafts. But around here, if you're going long distances, that's what you want to be in. Still not convinced, Neve said, then started walking toward the airship anyway. How do you get the helium? Kahurangi asked Tom as we walked. Are you getting it from natural gas? We mostly use an air distillation process. That's not very efficient. Tom waved at the thick air. It's more efficient here. There's more atmosphere, and helium occurs here more than back home. And the kaiju hide? Aparna said. How do you get that? Are you asking if we hunt the kaiju? I was wondering that, yes. Hunting a kaiju would be a very ambitious undertaking, Tom said, to use the mildest euphemisms possible. So no, kaiju die like anything else does. When they do, we scavenge the body. How does that happen? very carefully. We walked up the gangplank into the passenger area of the airship. For all that the outside of the Shobijin looked like rotted steampunk, the passenger cabin was nicely appointed. Modern lounger-style airline seats were placed in wide rows facing each other, with enough space between to move around and look out through broad windows. There were small lounge areas fore and aft, with bathroom facilities and snacks not in the same place. I glanced at Neve, who seemed slightly more reassured at the interior than the exterior. We found ourselves seats and plopped our stuff down and stored our carry-ons in cubbyholes in the baseboard. "Welcome back, fellow Tanaka Base Gold Team members," said the voice over the Shobijin speakers. "This is your pilot, Rodrigo Perez Schmidt, and with me as always is my co-pilot, Matthias Perez Schmidt. We're not related, we're just married." This got a low groan of familiarity. I had a feeling Rodrigo used this line with every announcement. "Today is a lovely day to travel, and we are delighted to travel with you. Our destination is the delightful Tanaka Base, located in the scenic and lovely Labrador Peninsula, almost straight south from us, a mere 2,650 kilometers distant. For you Americans, that's about 1,650 miles. And also, this is the last time you will hear imperial measurements used because, like the rest of the civilized universe, Kaiju Earth uses measurements that make logical sense." Another low groan, but very low, as the number of Americans appeared relatively small, and also they were scientists, so they use metric anyway. Once aloft, and barring any bad weather or kaiju attack, we newbies looked at each other with some concern, but no one else seemed to break what they were doing, we will be cruising at a comfortable 120 clicks per hour. Honda Base tells me Betsy is to the northeast, so we'll cruise at between 200 and 300 meters until we reach the sea. For you new members, welcome! And also, the majority of our voyage will be over Baffin Bay and the Labrador Sea, so it will not be as scenic as you would like. Nevertheless, I hope you will enjoy your time on the Shobijin. We will be at Tanaka Base in roughly 22 hours. Perez Schmidt made some comments to the Shobijin crew and then signed off. "Betsy?" Kahurangi asked Tom, who sat with us. "That's the local kaiju," Tom said. "You saw her when you got here. She was the one that looked like a small mountain."
"You named the kaiju Betsy?" I asked.
"I didn't. Someone else did. You have a problem with Betsy?"
I don't know. I was expecting something Japanese, or a name like Hammer Fist or something.
Formally, the adult ones have numbers. But the ones that live near bases get informal names, and they get named something easy to remember, like Betsy.
"Hammer Fist is easy to remember," Neve said.
"When it's your turn to name a local kaiju, you can name it that if you like."
"What if someone goes by that name?" Kahurangi asked.
"Hammer Fist?"
"Sure, but I meant Betsy in this case."
"It's the 21st century. No one goes by Betsy anymore," Tom said.
"But even if they did, there's usually context.
If you're saying Betsy has the results from the lab, it's probably the human. If it's Betsy just got pissed off and burned down 20,000 acres of jungle, it's probably the kaiju."
"I thought we weren't using imperial measures anymore," Neve said.
"I don't know what 20,000 acres is in metric."
"About 8,000 hectares, Aparna said.
Tom stared at her.
"Really? That fast?"
Aparna shrugged.
"It's just math."
Tom turned to me. "Did you know that?"
"I did not," I reassured him.
"Thank you. I lift things.
Hey, where does that road go?"
Neve, who had a seat close to a window, pointed to a wide and meandering path that became visible as we gently and quietly took to the air.
"It's not a road," Tom said. "It's a kaiju trail. They make them when they walk."
We all craned to look.
"Jesus, that's wide," Kahurangi said.
"Do they keep to their trails?" Aparna asked.
"Mostly," Tom said.
"For the same reason we walk on sidewalks and not in the bushes.
And here's something interesting. In places here that correspond to where humans live back home, the kaiju paths often mirror the paths of our major roads."
"They're following the topographic path of least resistance," Kahurangi said.
"Bingo."
"So where do they go?" I asked.
"The paths.
The adult kaiju have their own home territories. They clear out space in places that they like."
"And do those correspond to our cities?"
Tom smiled.
"They do sometimes."
He pointed to the path.
"In Betsy's case, though, this path more or less makes a loop around Honda Base. She seems curious about what we do here.
That or she's trying to find the nuclear reactor. She mostly doesn't bother us, though.
Mostly? Neve said. She's been known to chase the airships.
What?
Relax. She hasn't caught one yet.
Tom reconsidered. Well, not one with people on it. She's gotten a couple of drones.
Neve stared at Tom and then buckled up in their seat, emphatically.
We had crossed onto the Labrador Peninsula and were not too far off from Tanaka Base when a noise reverberated in the Shobijin cabin. Everyone fell silent. The noise came again, much closer.
Tell me that's not what I think it is, Neve said.
Rodrigo Perez Schmidt came on the speakers. Attention, Gold Team, we have a kaiju out of place. Kaiju out of place. Stand by. Everyone continued their silence. Then Perez Schmidt came back on the speakers. Attention, Gold Team. Correction. Two kaiju out of place. Preparing to climb. The cabin erupted with noise, and everyone rushed to the windows.
What does that mean? I asked Tom,
and then noticed him looking out the window with a not at all reassuring expression on his face. I turned to look out the window.
There was a very large creature staring up into the airship.
It was too close, and our path was bringing it closer.
Oh, shit, I said. I actually backed out of my chair.
There's another one, Kahurangi called out from a window on the other side of the cabin. I went over to him and looked where he was looking.
This other kaiju was just as brain-defyingly large. It looked at us briefly, then turned its attention back to the first kaiju. It was also too close, and we were also getting closer. In fact, our path was taking us directly between them, into the middle of whatever they were doing or were about to do to us.
Well, this seems bad, I said to Kahurangi. I turned back and yelled at Tom.
I thought we were supposed to be climbing.
We are climbing, he said.
Not fast enough, I was about to say,
when one of the kaiju screamed like 1,000 jet engines suddenly ignited and drowned out the possibility of hearing anything else ever.
That is until the kaiju on the other side of the airship answered just as loudly.
I wasn't aware it was possible to go completely deaf in stereo. The screaming stopped, or at least I thought it stopped. It was possible my eardrums had simply melted. Then came another rumbling, again in stereo. Someone screamed from inside the cabin. I looked back out the window and saw the kaiju on this side lumbering toward the airship, slowly but then picking up speed in a way that should be impossible given how large it actually was. I turned to warn the folks on the other side of the cabin and noticed through those windows the second kaiju running up on us just as quickly. Ridiculously, I ducked. There was a thundering sound and a jolt, and I was sure the cabin would soon tear itself apart, but it didn't. The noise was from below us, the sound of two kaiju colliding. We had actually climbed enough for them to miss us. It took me a couple of seconds to realize they weren't trying to kill us. They were trying to kill each other. The Shobijin turned slightly to the southwest, and the starboard side of the airship was treated to the spectacle of two creatures the size of skyscrapers trying to beat the crap out of each other. Kahurangi and I watched, joined by the other newbies and Tom.
What the hell just happened? I asked Tom.
I waved at the kaiju fight. How did the pilots miss this?
We have trackers on the adult kaiju, Tom said.
Sometimes we lose the signal, which means sometimes they show up where we don't expect them.
Yeah, like alongside our fucking airship, Neve said.
They look like terrain until they don't. Tom pointed to one of them. That's Kevin.
Really? Neve said. Fucking Kevin?
He's a local. I don't know who the other one is. It might be a new adult looking to claim territory.
So this is a turf war, Kahurangi said.
Tom gave the tensest shrug I think I've ever seen someone give.
Maybe. Could be a mating thing.
A massive chunk of kaiju flew into the air, trailing viscera as it did. Deafening screaming flooded the cabin.
Maybe not, Tom amended, when we could all hear again.
The kaiju who was not Kevin was stumbling away from Kevin now, crashing through trees in the general direction of the Shobijin.
Oh, no, 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 run the other way, you dim-witted pile of rock, Neve said.
It's all right, Tom said. Kevin's not going after the other one.
Okay, but what about that? Aparna said and pointed.
We all looked. Kevin had gouged up a clot of ground the size of a small park in his massive clawed fist and had cocked back a gargantuan arm.
Tool user, Aparna whispered, almost to herself.
I stared at her, half impressed she could be thinking about science at a time like this. The speakers popped on.
I would recommend seatbelts right about now, Rodrigo Perez Schmidt said.
We dived for our seats. As I clicked in, I saw Kevin pitch the small park in the direction of the other kaiju, which meant in our direction as well. The massive clod flew apart, and one sizable chunk sailed right toward us.
That has trees in it, my brain said.
And then the entire cabin violently rocked and swayed as the spray of earth and rock and trees pelted the Shobijin at an oblique angle, pummeling the airship before falling prey to gravity. We did not fall prey to gravity. We stayed afloat and kept going.
How are we even alive? Neve asked, again speaking for all of us.
We were hit by trees.
I told you this thing was tough, Tom said.
I looked around the cabin. Windows were shattered, but had stayed in their frames. Carry-ons had dislodged from their cubbyholes. One woman didn't make it to her seat on time and was now holding the side of her head with a small trickle of blood oozing out. But, otherwise, everyone seemed safe. Tom was right. The Shobijin looked ramshackle, but it survived the attack.
Well, survived two kaiju attacking each other and being collateral damage.
Which, I think, was as close as I wanted to get to actually being attacked by a kaiju.
Tell me it isn't always like this, I said to Tom. The trees being chucked at us by a kaiju, I mean.
First time it's ever happened to me, Tom promised. The speakers clicked on again. Gold team, just reported into Tanaka base. You'll be happy to know Kevin's tracker is safe and sound and reporting in from 80 clicks away, Perez Schmidt said. Best thinking is one of his parasites dislodged it somehow. Anyhow, now some of us will have a new mission on the schedule, getting him another tracker. Sorry about the surprise. If we'd known, we'd have taken her up before we hit land. The good news is, we're still on schedule, and we don't anticipate any more surprises between here and the base. He clicked off.
No one anticipates surprises, Kahurangi said. That's what makes them surprises.
In the distance now, there was a mournful cry of a mountain in pain.
Chapter 7.
About 15 minutes before arrival, a gold team member walked through the cabin distributing hats and gloves. Everyone took them, and so did we. The gloves looked suspiciously small, as did the hat, which looked like a cap with a veil that went all the way around.
This looks like a jellyfish, I said.
A small one. It stretches, Tom said. So do the gloves. Put them on. The veil attaches to your suit like Velcro. Get a good seal. He nodded to Aparna and Kahurangi, both of whom had long hair. You'll want to tuck your hair into your cap.
Well, this is a fashion statement, Neve said when we had all put on our accessories.
I'm guessing insects, Aparna said. Bitey ones. You're not wrong, Tom said.
How bad are they?
Tom smiled. The good news is it's only until we get to the base proper. The bad news is that's 200 meters. Look, Neve pointed out the window. I think we're here. Out of the trees was a clearing, either a natural or man-made meadow. On one side of it, on pylons, was an immense wooden hangar, accompanied by smaller hangars on each side. I assumed the large one was for the Shobijin, and the smaller ones for things like helicopters or tinier airships. This suspicion was confirmed as I saw what looked like a two-person helicopter being towed out onto an adjoining pad. A small distance away was another platform that looked like it held, of all things, a refinery. Farther out, another platform holding an array of solar panels and three lazily turning vertical wind turbines. Some distance away from all of that was the Shobijin's mooring station, alongside which were mobile gangways that led to a platform raised off the meadow floor. From the platform, a walkway stretched up and over into a gathering of sequoia-sized trees. Among the trees were wooden platforms and walkways and buildings, the whole affair swaddled in what looked like fine nettings and coverings.
"That's Tanaka Base?" I asked.
"It is. Did you mean to make it look like an Ewok village, or was that just an accident?"
"Well, technically speaking, Tanaka predates the Ewok village by a couple of decades, so it looks like us."
"Does George Lucas know that?"
"He might."
The Shobi Jin was maneuvered into her moorings, and the gangways extended. We had officially landed. People got up and grabbed their things.
"Ready?" Tom said.
The doors opened. We shuffled out, stepped through the doorway onto the gangplank, and were immediately swarmed by apparently all the small flying insects that ever existed in the history of the universe.
"Jesus," Kahurangi said, swatting. "Don't swat," Tom said to him. "It just encourages them. They're very excited to eat me."
"It's not personal. They want to eat everyone. Just keep walking."
"Is this usual?" I asked.
"This is light," Tom said. He pointed to Tanaka Base, which everyone was moving speedily toward. "Now you know why the whole place is screened in."
"You could have warned me about the danger of being exsanguinated in my first 5 minutes here," I said.
"It gets better," he said. "Watch." He pointed to the long walkway into the base, which was covered and screened. As we got closer, I heard the sound of fans blowing air forcefully away from the entrance of the covered walkway, blowing away the swarm as they did so. 10 steps into the covered walkway, and the number of flying insects had dropped from dangerous to merely annoying. 25 steps in, and they were mostly gone. I admired the lack of bloodthirsty creatures.
"Nice.
The big blowers go on when sensors notice someone approaching," Tom said. "But the fans are always blowing a light breeze through the walkway, away from Tanaka. It's a determined bloodsucker that makes it all the way in."
"And if they do?
Well, that's why we keep frogs, of course."
"What?"
Tom ignored the question and pointed to my cap and veil ensemble. "Out in the world, this will keep most of the small ones away from you. The bigger ones, the ones near water, are the ones you want to look out for. They smell your breath, they come right for your face."
"How big are they?" Aparna asked.
"The bigger ones you don't swat. You punch."
"I can't tell if you're joking," Aparna said after a minute.
"The air here is thicker and has more oxygen in it than it did on Earth when we had insects with a meter-long wingspan," Tom said. "You're the biologist. You tell me."
Aparna sighed. "Punchable insects. Okay, got it."
From ahead of us, the first of Gold Team had made it into Tanaka, and cheering had started going up. We all looked at Tom.
"That's Red Team," he said. "The people we're replacing. They are very happy to see us."
We cleared the walkway and were immediately confronted by several dozen people cheering us, wearing festive shirts over their jumpsuits, straw hats of various sorts, playing ukuleles and guitars, and holding up drinks, presumably Red Team. When all of Gold Team had made it up the walkway and stripped off their insect caps, there was a dramatic shushing. And then Bryn McDonald stepped forward to a man in a particularly loud shirt, wearing a particularly ratty straw hat, holding a particularly large drink.
"Bryn McDonald, commander of KPS Tanaka Base Gold Team, here with my team to formally relieve KPS Tanaka Base Red Team," she said.
"João Silva, commander of KPS Tanaka Base Red Team," the man in the loud shirt and terrible hat said. "I am formally relieved you are here."
Silva reached up and put his ratty-ass hat on McDonald. A wild cheer went up from both camps. Silva and McDonald hugged, and then Silva took off the terrible shirt and presented it to McDonald, who put it on, apparently signaling the transfer of authority. With that, members of Red Team surged forward and welcomed their counterparts, handing over hats and shirts and musical instruments, but not drinks. I was personally accosted by a friendly chap who gave me a ukulele, a straw boater, and a polyester shirt with parrots on it. "It is you," he assured me, gave me a hug, and wandered off.
"You know how to play that thing?" Kahurangi asked me.
He was clad in an orange shirt with white bucking broncos on it and a straw trilby.
"Not a clue," I assured him.
"May I?" I handed the ukulele to him. He started playing it like he'd been playing it all his life, which maybe he had. He smiled when he saw me looking at him play. I debated about whether to bring mine. I decided against it, and I regretted it almost as soon as we left. I'm glad they had one here. More than one, it looks like. I can teach you how to play if you want. In our, I'm sure, voluminous free time. I'd like that, I said. Kahurangi grinned and then wandered off, playing as he went. I turned back to Tom, who had been festooned with a sombrero and a loud shirt with kittens. So there's two teams at Tanaka Base and we rotate? Tom shook his head. Three teams. Each team has a six-month stay, offset 3 months with the other teams. He pointed at the now de-headed red team. Red team has been here for 6 months, and they're about to get 3 months off back home. He waved farther into the base where I could see the other KPS personnel. Blue team arrived 3 months ago to relieve us so we could have a three-month break, and will be here for another 3 months. Then they will be relieved by red team, who will be returning. Every team works with every other team for 3 months. That way, Tanaka is always fully staffed, and there's always continuity. I pointed at Tom's kitten shirt. And this? We do this every 3 months? You have something against loud shirts and ugly hats? Yours are loud and ugly. Mine, on the other hand, are quite fetching. We just do it when we arrive and leave. The middle transfer, we keep things running while the other two teams do their transfer. Like Blue Team is doing right now. I fingered my shirt. And, do we keep the shirts and hats? Tom smiled. You can if you want, but they usually go back into the storeroom. The musical instruments are community property, too. We usually sign them out. We're big on the community sharing here. Which reminds me, you said you brought books and movies on hard drives? You should let our IT people know. They'll add them to the community Plex server. Okay. You have licenses for all that stuff, right? That's a joke. The treaty we work under creates a special carve-out for us in terms of copyright. Really? Yeah, apparently they thought if we were being sent to an alternate Earth ruled by 150-meter-tall creatures who could step on us at every moment, we should be able to borrow each other's e-books and watch Stranger Things. Seems fair. Helps keep us sane, anyway. More than just ukuleles. Someone called Tom's name. He looked around, saw the person, and waved. You don't have to babysit me, I said to him. If you have people to say goodbye to, go do that. All right, thanks, he said. Also, in a little bit, Bryn McDonald is probably going to collect you and your friends to help get you situated. Then tomorrow, she's going to start you on your actual orientation. You know, starting on your actual job. I lift things, I confirmed. You will indeed lift things, Tom agreed. But there's also going to be more to it than that. Dun, 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 I said, mimicking dramatic music. Tom laughed and left. And I turned and watched two groups of friends, one arriving and one departing, try to catch up on 3 months' worth of life in a couple of all too short hours. Let me start by informing you that I'm a little drunk right now, so I'm going to keep this very short, Bryn McDonald said. She was holding a glass of something, presumably alcoholic. We newbies, whom she had gathered on Tanaka Base's main thoroughfare, waited politely. Many of us may also have been a little drunk. The red team goodbye party had been a little more intense than we expected. First, welcome. I'm Bryn, but you knew that. I know who each of you are because I have your files, but I'm also, you'll recall, a little drunk right now, so I'm not going to pretend to remember which of you is which. I will have it down tomorrow, I promise. And speaking of tomorrow, she pointed to a modest wooden structure a bit down the path. I'll see all of you.